Gold closed today at a 9-year high. Now we're not doing a safe haven story. Think Federal Reserve. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 21st of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a personnel story. President Trump's proposed staffing of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. The Senate Banking Committee voted today on two of the president's nominees. Economist Chris Waller, he's the current executive vice president and head of research at the St. Louis Fed, was approved easily. The other nominee, economist Judy Shelton, was approved with a much thinner margin, 13 to 12, straight party line. Both, of course, have to go to the full Senate for approval, but Shelton's controversial here for a couple of reasons. She has said the Federal Reserve ought to be much more closely aligned with the White House, an interesting point of view on a famously independent agency. And she has said she wants to put this economy back on the gold standard, which we got rid of almost 50 years ago. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reminds us why the gold standard is such a central banking hot potato.
This morning, I pulled out a $5 bill to pay for my coffee, and just below the Federal Reserve seal, it says, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private." What it doesn't say is, this piece of paper can be redeemed for $5 worth of U.S. government gold. Once upon a time, it could be, though. I asked University of Oklahoma economist Gary Hoover to give me the 30-second monetary history.
Initially, we actually printed gold coins.
But carrying around all those heavy coins was cumbersome, so the government decided,
okay, let's print out paper money, but they'll be redeemable for certain amounts of gold.
That lasted until World War I, when the government needed to borrow and print a lot of money to fund the war. Then there was a Great Depression, another world war, and the U.S. gradually went off the gold standard altogether.
And now we simply have paper dollars, which are the good faith of the United States government.
Now, every economist I talked to today dismissed out of hand the idea of the U.S. going back to the gold standard. But Scott Sumner at George Mason University's Mercatus Center says he does understand the appeal of the idea to cut the Fed out of its current role of controlling the money supply in the economy.
Keeping the value of money strong and, in some sense, removing the role of government from the monetary system, those are things that attract people to the gold standard.
But he says in the face of a great recession or pandemic downturn, the Fed needs its current monetary tools.
The central bank, the Fed, can inject more dollars into the economy. Under a gold standard where dollars have to be backed for gold, there's much less ability to do that.
And without the ability to control how much the dollar is worth, the U.S. can't make its exports cheaper and more competitive, which is especially useful during a downturn. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The byword of this pandemic so far... Well, there are probably a lot of bywords, actually. Pick your own. But the one I'm thinking of right now is adaptation. We are all adapting in one way or another to our changed circumstances. And for working parents, those circumstances include juggling childcare, homeschooling, because what's going to happen there is kind of up in the air, as you know, along with their full-time jobs. They're juggling all that stuff. So the parental adaptation, pandemic pods. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Taking care of twin 9-year-old girls has become almost a full-time job for DC photographer Delaine Rouse. He could use a break, but he's not sending the kids back to school in the fall.
It doesn't matter how much you learn if they're not alive, right?
He started seeing similar concerns from other parents on Facebook.
And just thinking, how can we make this thing work, but maybe not having to be responsible for all the learning for 5 days a week?
So he's looking into a pod, the idea being that trusted households can safely gather. Along with a teacher, they'd hire and share the costs.
I'm a mathematics specialist that can provide 1.5 hour sessions to your pod.
Former math teacher Jeffrey Hahn posted that classified ad on his Brooklyn neighborhood forum yesterday. His base rate for pod teaching is $250 a session, and he's already getting interest. So is Mike Tang, who runs Swing Education, a company that matches substitute teachers to schools in California and several other states, and now hires them for private learning pods.
And it ends up being priced in a range that's close to what private daycare or private childcare might look like.
Which, of course, raises concerns about equity. The pandemic has already widened disparities in our education system, says Matthew Kraft, a professor of economics and education at Brown.
I don't fault parents for trying to be creative, but why can't we provide that type of opportunity for all students?
He says federal investments could help match newly graduated college students or educators who have lost work to provide pod-style tutoring for all families. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Little up, a little down in equities today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's the political and epidemiological side of the Trump administration's recent change in how COVID data is getting tracked, moving it from the Centers for Disease Control to the Department of Health and Human Services. It is not without controversy. But there is also the practical side, as the new data tracking site went live yesterday. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports that hospitals already in the middle of a pandemic have a whole new system to learn now.
Less than half of the nation's hospitals reported to the old system. About three quarters will report to the new system, and they'll have to enter the data manually. Catherine Baker, a health economist at the University of Chicago, says the goal here is commendable.
Having harmonized information is really crucial both to individual decision making, but also to getting resources in the right place at the right time.
The problem is,
ideally, you wouldn't be starting to do it in a pandemic.
Not only during the pandemic, but with only days of notice, according to Dave Dillon of the Missouri Hospital Association.
We have not had the ramp-up period to encourage hospitals to engage in this.
But hospitals will have to engage if they want resources the federal government controls, such as the scarce supply of antiviral drugs. Dillon says the changeover has been
more of a sanction than an inducement.
And hospitals are already stretched thin by the pandemic, says Georges Benjamin, president of the American Public Health Association. The confusion over what to report and to whom and how may actually impair federal efforts.
In many ways, it may very well delay the response that they're having. And I think that's the biggest risk, that it really undermines their ability to move as quickly as they would like.
Benjamin says understaffed and underfunded hospitals may not have the resources to devote to typing information into this platform. And those are the hospitals that could most use help from the federal government. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Negotiations over what a new federal government economic support plan started to take shape today. The Secretary of the Treasury and others from the White House were up on Capitol Hill making the rounds. At issue, keeping some kind of extended unemployment benefits, the $600 a week we've been telling you about, that goes away next week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants liability protections for companies from coronavirus lawsuits. And the President of the United States says he wants a payroll tax cut. That particular line item isn't getting a whole lot of attraction right now, but Washington's a funny town that way. Things just happen sometimes. So today, a payroll tax primer.
So a payroll tax is a tax on earnings, and the more that you earn, the more that you pay.
That's Chris Cox, senior tax policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You and your employer, generally speaking, each pay those taxes on every paycheck, hence payroll taxes. 6.2% to help fund Social Security, another 1.45% for Medicare. You cut those taxes, people get more money to spend, right? It's been done before. President Obama cut payroll taxes 2% back in 2011. But today,
in this economic climate, when millions of people have lost their jobs, the payroll tax cut delivers zero benefits to the jobless.
Remember, we told you yesterday, 32.5 million Americans are getting unemployment benefits of one kind or another from the government. So, some other suggestions from Chris Cox.
Expansion and extension of unemployment insurance and state fiscal relief to states and localities who otherwise will have to make large budget cuts and could result in many people losing additional jobs.
Which is also, by the way, that fiscal relief for states, a big bone of contention in this next package as well. On the list of positive developments in the world today, there is this. Marketplace has a new podcast launched today for kids and their families, answering those tricky-to-answer questions that kids have about money. The show is called Million Bazillion. Here is a little teaser from episode one. If you had all the money in the world, what would you do?
If I had all the money in the world,
first, I would fly my private jet to San Diego to my favorite taco place called the Taco Stand.
I would give it to some foundations that help the world.
I would give dogs from the shelter homes.
Then I would donate to charity.
If I had all the money in the world, I would make a 100 feet tall robot.
I would buy a football stadium.
I would plant multiple forests. Then I would buy a hang glider.
Buy some FIFA points and save the rest for later.
I would be rich.
That was Benny in Irvine, California, Eloise in Connecticut, Xiomara and Xavier in Austin, Texas, Sevian and Ezra here in Los Angeles from our new podcast, Million Bazillion. The first episode is out right now, all about, by the way, who invented money. Downloadable pretty much wherever you like. Coming up.
If you really want to make a change in the world, you can do it with the things that you're putting on the table.
Food, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 159 points today, 0.6%, 26,840. The NASDAQ down 86 points, 0.8%, 10,680. The S&P 500 found 5 points in the couch cushions, about a 0.1%, 32.57 there. Lots of quarterly earnings reports to talk about, so here we go. Coca-Cola reported a 33% year-over-year sales decline, but gave rosier guidance for the future, thus shares bubbled up. Get it? Bubbled up, Coke? 2.3%. I love my job. IBM reported better than expected profit and revenue results for the quarter. Shares down 0.2%. United Airlines reported second quarter profits today. Revenue down 99.0%. Shares, though, up during the session 2.25%. Up after hours as well. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Were I to ask you to name the biggest, most important companies in this economy, you would do Amazon, right? Apple, for sure. Facebook, maybe. Probably not, though, General Electric. But once upon a time, and not that long ago either, GE was the most valuable company in America, making and or selling everything from home appliances to television shows to oil. Now, not so much. The company's fall is the subject of a new book called Lights Out, Pride, Delusion, and the Fall of General Electric. Tom Grida and Ted Mann from The Wall Street Journal wrote it. Tom Grida, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me the story, would you, the anecdote with which you start this book. John Flannery, the then about-to-be new CEO of one of the great American industrial conglomerates, goes to one of the big subsidiaries, GE Power, I think it was, up in Schenectady, and starts going through the books. Tell me that story.
Yeah, I mean, this was a moment where John Flannery had been named to the coveted position of becoming the next CEO of GE, and he was examining the operations, and what he found was not what he expected. The power business was a mess. There were some accounting shenanigans going on. GE's biggest deal ever was buying this French power company, and the integration has been quite a mess, and all this is going on as the power market is taking a turn. So their bet essentially was failing.
You end with a quote from Mr. Flannery that I cannot repeat here on this family-oriented public radio program. But suffice it to say, he was shocked. And the question is, to step back to the 30,000-foot view, how did GE fall so far so fast?
You know, I think part of it is that GE never thought it could fail. It was unbreakable. Costs got out of control. They took their eyes off of operations. The idea, you know, they would do these deals that didn't work out and nobody worried about it too much because GE is so big that they could absorb missteps. But there are limits and they exceeded them.
Maybe it would be helpful for people who don't follow this closely, certainly as closely as you and passingly as I do. How was GE thought of in this economy back in its heyday?
It was, for investors, it was an essential part of the portfolio. They were one or two in almost every industry they were in. For folks in the factory floor, it was like a lottery ticket, you know, great pension, great benefits. And this goes back decades. It really was this iconic model of American corporate culture.
And just speaking as a guy who hosts a radio program on which the General Electric theme song used to be embedded in our theme music, and longtime listeners will remember that, and maybe we should dig it out and put it on the web. It was a consumer products too, right? It made appliances and all that good stuff.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Appliances, light bulbs, some of these products still have the GE logo on it because they've licensed them. We have a General Electric air conditioner in our house, but it's made by a Chinese company now. And I think that still holds true for a lot of people. It's a very recognizable brand. I think people, you know, feel that it's this sort of inherently American company.
Okay, but the reality now of General Electric as a corporate structure is completely different. What does GE look like today?
Today, they are basically power, aviation, which makes jet engines. They essentially dominate the jet engine market. And healthcare, which they make x-ray machines, CT scanners, MRIs. In all those industries, they have innovated for decades. They have gotten out of pretty much everything consumer. They recently sold the last piece of their light bulb business. So it's very much a changed company in recent years.
Do you think a General Electric could start up again today?
To be honest, if you could look at Amazon or Google and you could argue that these companies are conglomerates, what is key to a conglomerate these days is it's about its management. And so if you have the right leadership, it's possible that you could make that work. Now, could you make it work for decades? And could some of these companies that are structured like conglomerates, could they survive 120, 130 years like General Electric has? Time will tell.
Yeah. Tom Greida with Ted Mann, both at the Wall Street Journal, have a new book out about General Electric. It's called Lights Out, Pride, Delusion, and the Fall of General Electric. Tom, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks for having me on.
We've got an excerpt from Tom and Ted's book about that failed acquisition of the French company Tom mentioned and why nobody at GE stopped it. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Also there, and you're going to want to check this out, that old Marketplace theme music I mentioned with the GE audio logo in it, it's there. It's kind of wild. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is, of course, the government's main office for citizenship and immigration services, says it's going to have to furlough 2/3 of its staff unless Congress sends $1.2 billion its way by the first week of August. Why, I hear you asking? Because it's funded by user fees. And as applications for legal immigration have dropped because fewer people want to come here, the agency is running out of money. And that means, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, that for people trying to get work visas or green cards, an already long and arduous process is going to get longer and more arduous.
Suraj Vyas came to the United States in 2002 to get a master's degree in computer science in North Carolina. He's been working under an H-1B visa since 2005, and he got tentative approval for permanent residence 4 years later. He's been waiting for his green card ever since.
After a certain period of time, we just stopped looking.
Suraj and his wife Garima have two daughters born in America. Garima is a dentist, and together they own their own practice in York, Pennsylvania, where they employ 7 people. He still works in IT and has to renew his visa every couple of years.
There is like a sword hanging on your neck all the time, because unless you get your green card in your hand, you never know what happens if your H1 gets denied next time.
Manan Shah, a data specialist in Austin, Texas, is also waiting for his green card. But he's got a more pressing concern right now. He needs to visit his father in India, who has cancer. Shah's waiting for immigration officials to give him documentation that will allow him to get back into America.
If they are already backlogged and if they remove people, my worry is it might even cause further delay.
In a lot of ways, Shah's experience is typical.
To be an immigrant in this country is to shift from one anxiety to the next.
Alan Orr is president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. He says the USCIS budget is so dire because it has discouraged new applicants, doubled the amount of money it spends on fraud prevention, and tripled what it spends on vetting.
So the shortfall right now with the budget is from mismanagement of the government by imposing new regulations that weren't needed.
USCIS declined comment. The agency also made it more expensive to apply for a visa, raising fees earlier this year to make up for fewer applications. Richard Burke, CEO of Envoy Global, a firm that helps companies navigate the visa process, says companies are willing to pay those higher fees, but just want certainty. Employers are worried that a reduction in USCIS staff could mean they don't get the workers that they need.
Those that we serve view this as an entirely self-inflicted wound, and the consequence is just another challenge as these companies try to rebound from COVID and seek to hire the best and brightest.
Without intervention from Congress, the shortfall threatens to put more than 13,000 USCIS employees on furlough beginning August 3rd. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The United States is the biggest agricultural trading partner Mexico has. And as here, a lot of small local farmers in Mexico wind up competing with big ag conglomerates. And with the pandemic, they're having to adapt to changes in farm production as well. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
In the state of Veracruz on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, Aurelia Valema recorded some of the sounds from the jungle where she grows organic produce and medicinal herbs. She uses them in lotions that she sells for her business called Nantli. She says she has been forced by the pandemic to reinvent her business. Normally she ships her products throughout Mexico, but customers haven't ordered anything since April. She had to shut down her first store close to where she lives, which opened 15 days before the pandemic. So during this pause, Valema says she's been taking online seminars about gardening to improve her skills.
Los e-books, o sea, hacer un curso.
And the entrepreneur also is using this time to share her knowledge. She created a free ebook on how to farm vegetables at home and plans to teach people about organic gardening using social media. She hopes to find customers that way, but at the moment she's living on her savings. In Mexico City, Enrique Cervantes is also reinventing his business.
We are trying to make a bridge between the people from the field with the people from the city.
Cervantes organized Bonito Tianguis, an organic produce street market that has been around for 9 years. The last bazaar held in January attracted more than 15,000 people in 4 days, but the pandemic changed everything.
We have canceled 6 events.
When the street market business closed, he opened a new store. It's not replacing the street market business, but he says at least it's helping him survive.
If you really want to make a change in the world, you don't have to wait so the government makes it. You don't have to wait for the next American election. You can do it with the things that you're putting on the table.
Some farmers are flourishing in the pandemic, like Plantas y Flores de Xochimilco. It's a community of dozens of family-owned businesses that grow decorative plants at the outskirts of Mexico City.
Rosa del Desierto.
Esteban de Jesus Duran is a member of the organization. He shows me a cargo of potted flowers, tall plants, and perfumed shrubs. These are all being delivered to customers in quarantine. Many people have found about it through Instagram, which the growers are using to sell plants. Duran says the sales are up 60 to 70% since the pandemic. He says the government recently requested that Plantas y Flores de Xochimilco close some of its facilities on weekends to decrease the chance of spreading COVID-19. This could seriously affect the business, as many plants need daily care. But Duran says they'll keep improving their business model to build loyalty among customers. He says growth is important not only for sales, but also for benefiting families that depend on it. In Mexico City, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, it has been 59 years in a row that Congress has passed and presidents of each party have signed a key piece of legislation known as the National Defense Authorization Act, the Pentagon's spending package, basically. The House's version this year coming in at $740 billion, including a 3% pay raise for the military and $1 billion for the coronavirus. Oh, also, language in the Senate version requiring the Department of Defense to rename military bases currently memorializing Confederate heroes. The White House said today if that provision is in the bill sent to the president, he will veto it. One note here for the record, the Trump administration frequently makes threats it doesn't follow through on. Here is your moment of economic context for this Tuesday, ere we leave you, the European edition today. The EU agreed on a coronavirus rescue package early this morning, Europe time, almost $2 trillion in all. Here's why it's interesting, though. Number one, it was a unanimous vote of all 27 EU members. Remember, there used to be 28, but Brexit. Also, number two, you can make a case that after Brexit and all the warnings about the end of the EU, this actually brings that bloc closer together. I don't know. We'll see. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand, and I am Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.